In the U.S., there are riots on the streets of Los Angeles. And in London, people are also taking to the streets, though not quite as violently, but certainly just as angry. There may be an irony that these things continually happen in two countries who spend so much time lecturing the rest of the world on how they should treat its citizens. I'm Rick Sanchez, and you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to give you a different perspective on these events with the help of a former CIA agent that, well, it's a perspective that's not usually taken with something like this. So let's do this. So in a moment, what I'm going to do for you is I want to split the frame so that you can actually see these two stories as they have unfolded. Mind you, they're taking place in two of the most important cities in the Western world. On the left, there you can see it, protesters in California who are angry at the Trump administration for what they see as the hasty and unfair roundup of undocumented immigrants. Look, it's a complicated story that is rife with anger and misunderstanding. And now on the right there, you can see on your screen, thousands of people that are taking to the streets of central London. They are screaming, demanding, really, that their government stop spending all of their money, all of their tax money on wars and places they say like Gaza, Ukraine, instead of on them. They call these demonstrations, by the way, welfare, not warfare.
No money for food banks, hospitals, or schools. Shame!
Shame!
They refuse to fund life, but will always fight billions for death.
Are these really different protests? I mean, the one that I showed you in Los Angeles, the other one that's taking place in London? Well, yeah, of course they're different, but they're also very much the same. You see, whether you are an immigrant in the United States and you think you're being treated harshly, which many of them are, or you're a U.S. citizen, for example, in the United States, who wishes these immigrants who they say are invading their country would just go away, right? The origin of the problem for both is the same. It's foreign policy. It's the U.S.'s foreign policy. Here's why. The average, quote, illegal would have loved to stay in his own country, but they couldn't. They can't. People like my mother, my father, they came to America because their own country is just too dangerous or too ridden with crime or gangs or cartels. Oh, by the way, guess where those cartels get their weapons? American gun makers. And by the way, those people who then come to the United States are hired by U.S. companies to work cheap, thereby reducing the value of American workers. This is like a cycle that just goes around and around and around and for years, if not decades. But now President Trump, he's trying to change it. And he's getting praise, which he probably should. And he's also getting resistance, which also may be understandable. That resistance has a face. In fact, here it is. You know, it's kind of amazing to watch that in my country, but it's not so unusual, actually. There have been many episodes with things like this. But you know what's funny about this particular situation? These riot conditions in Los Angeles, they actually could end up helping Trump politically. Let me explain. You see, Trump's anti-illegal movement, and it is a movement, it needs a face, needs a look, right? And these angry masked rioters that you just saw in that video, waving the Mexican flag and burning police cars and throwing rocks at police, setting things on fire, that's exactly that. That's the face that the enemy that Mr. Trump needs for his political movement, as horrible as that may sound. Mr. Trump's polls, by the way, have been teetering. 47%, 50%, 52%. So he's basically staying in that range around 50%. it's very likely this situation could give it a boost. But this story, this story is bigger than Trump. The story is, in many ways, even, I think, bigger than politics. It's really about a root cause, right? What's the origin of this? Where does this start? A root cause that hopefully Mr. Trump will find a way to alter. I want to show you something. Take a look at this map. Look at this. These are the 56 places where the United States has intervened militarily. Panama, Chile, Cuba, Guatemala, Nicaragua, Honduras, Mexico. I mean, look, I could be here all day, right? The list goes on and on and on. And it happens to essentially coincide with, interestingly enough, many of those same immigrants from those countries that are now in the United States, maybe even some of those that you saw now protesting in Los Angeles. This is the story that is often not told, not to Americans, not to angry citizens, not to the immigrants who have tried to make America, for example, their home. Now, let's look at the other story now. Let's look at London. This is a little different, but nonetheless, it's important. This is where people are also angry. London's crime rate, you've seen it. It's through the roof. The economy, for the average worker, dismal. Immigrants from war-torn countries like Syria, Iraq, Libya, and others, they're competing for space. They're competing for jobs. They're competing for hospitals. They're competing for schools, right? And those immigrants are bringing with them a foreign culture, a language, a religion, which creates even more tension. You know, it's like that famous Fessinger cockroach experiment where everybody starts competing for the same thing, and they actually, in the experiment, ate each other. And by the way, explaining all of this, can you blame Brits for feeling angry? This is not about blame. But let me show you something. This is a little bit of a busy graphic I'm going to show you. But it's really meant to be busy because it is a busy subject, right? And what I want to do is I want to illustrate for you. I want to show you just how much the UK has interfered in the affairs of other countries since the end of World War II. Go ahead, Gene. Let's run this scroll so people can look at this. Look at this. These are military interventions. If it wasn't so serious, I mean, and if it didn't cause so many deaths of so many people, it would seem crazy, right? This is a real deal I'm showing you here. Starts with Greece, 1944, runs through places like Kenya, Cameroon, Uganda, all kinds of countries in Africa, Syria, Iraq, and finishes with, you guessed it, Ukraine. Which is why these thousands of protesters in places like central London are now saying, look, we've had enough.
It's been an arms-selling country, and it's always pissed me off. Arms to Israel pisses me off. Building up the defences the way they're building them up, I don't think it's a good thing. No, we need to address Russia in another way, a different way.
He's not going to get anywhere near Warsaw, never mind about Berlin or Calais. So this is scaremongering. It's irresponsible scaremongering. And it's irresponsible scaremongering in the name of taking money out of the pockets of working people and giving it to arms corporations. £1 spent on the defence industry produces far less jobs than £1 spent in practically any other area.
Labour has proved to be no better than the Tories it replaced, and we need something different. We need something better.
You know, Russia's probably already won, and the West can't bear to admit that, so they're playing games.
You know, we're going to do a couple of things here when we come back. We're going to take a little break, but first, interestingly enough, President Putin has just commented a little while ago on something that has a lot to say about this particular topic, talking about the culture of the West, the incidence of things like, well, the protests that we're seeing in Los Angeles, the protests that we're seeing in places like London. And what's the effect of that? It's interesting. They're not dissimilar from words he's kind of used in the past, but I think it really comes to play during this conversation. So I'm going to share with you what Mr. Putin's words are. And then we're going to be joined by a former intelligence analyst for the CIA. So when we talk, about what's happening in some of these countries, when we talk about the United States and interventions in places like Latin America, interventions by the UK in places like Africa and the Middle East, this is a guy who knows exactly how that goes down, what happened, when it changed, and maybe perhaps, as some have been saying, why it got worse. Larry Johnson, he knows a thing or two about U.S. foreign policy, and he's going to be joining us here in just a little bit. Don't go away. We'll be right back. All right, our guest is here. His name is Larry. You want to see him? Take a look. Here he is. on a two-shot with Rick Sanchez.
In the flesh.
In fact, you look fantastic.
Yeah.
Before I talk with you, though, I want to show you something. This is kind of cool because we're interesting talking. Before I go to Larry, I want to do a little comparison for you. Okay, so these are the pictures of the people at the protest in Los Angeles waving the Mexican flag, and I can understand why a lot of people are angry about this. After all, that's not the American flag, right? So the question then is, why are they waving the Mexican flag, right? As Mr. Trump would say, why are they waving the Mexican flag, right? But okay, now I want to show you something else. Take a look at this video, right? Look at the video. What is that? That's the Ukraine flag. Why are these people in Congress waving the Ukraine flag all over the place? It's in there. I went there. I went to Congress. It's all over. Every senator, every congressman, especially the neocons, mostly Democrats, have this flag. They hold it up during commission. And then there's another one, the Israel flag, all over the place in the United States. Isn't that the flag of Israel? Right there. There it is, prominently being displayed in Washington by politicians. And by the way, don't you dare criticize that flag, or you probably won't be working, doing whatever it is that you are doing. Larry, let me bring you in on this real quick, because we're talking about those protests that are taking place in California, which, by the way, I opined moments ago that they're probably going to end up helping Mr. Trump because it kind of gives a face to the thing that he is talking about. I know as a former CIA intelligence officer, that's not necessarily your purview, but right. I know you study domestic politics. Yeah. What do you think of that situation, how it's going to affect Mr. Trump?
Well, it's already hit his approval rating. It's gone up double digits.
I'm not surprised.
And in fact, that was our old associate CNN was reporting that.
Hmm.
It went from like negative 20 to it's like plus one now.
You know, it's funny, but the thing that frustrates me, and I don't know if you caught a little bit of my introduction, but what we leave out of the equation, I understand people who are angry with immigrants who are taking over their communities. And I understand immigrants who are angry because they think they're coming to the United States to do good things, and most of them do.
Yeah, yeah.
But what people don't talk about is the reason, the origins, the why. The why is very simple. We have intervened in so many countries in Latin America. Oh. The people from those countries, you're a CIA guy, I want to ask you about it. The people from those countries end up being the ones who come to the United States, not because they want to, because they have to.
Well, after we're done, I'm going to show you photos from Tyson's Corner. I was in Tyson's Corner the other day picking up, had to go to Washington to pick my visa up to Russia.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I was in Lahore or Kabul.
Really?
I kid you not. The number of women walking around with the garb that women wear in Afghanistan and Pakistan, yeah. And men.
Wow.
I mean, it was the full pajama outfit.
And it's not like you and I are saying, I think, right? I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I'm glad that there are people from different cultures coming to a country. But if the only reason they're coming is because we're having war, making wars in their countries and forcing them to come.
Yeah.
And that's screwed up.
Yeah, they didn't come there because they said, you know, they got a really good lattes at Tyson's Corner. they were forced out of their country once when the Taliban took over because they had cooperated with the West, and now they were potential victims.
And that creates a cultural shift in countries like the UK, the United States, Paris, Germany, Eastern. Let me show you something. Mr. Putin just put something out a little while ago. Let me put my glasses on because it's a little small for me. He said this. He was just talking, this is about a half hour ago. He said, Western countries are trying to export their values, their models, and are exported around the world. They're trying to impose them, unfortunately. It's clear why they're doing it. It's easier to turn people into vassals if they stop being independent.
Yeah.
This kind of comes into play. I mean, he's kind of right.
Well, look, the one thing I've always encountered, you know, this is my fifth trip to Russia.
Yeah.
Fourth time to Moscow, once to St. Petersburg. The thing that sets the Russians apart from, Americans is the Russians don't feel compelled to force their values on you.
Yeah.
They're not like proselytizers or, television preachers. They sort of let you be what you are.
Mm.
And, I think part of that is that the Russians don't have a legacy of being a colonial empire.
There is a certain unity of culture in this country that I have seen. Like you, I've not been here long enough, but the little I have seen is this. And let's just do comparisons. You're an American, I'm an American. So I don't see men with their pants below their butts. I don't see people who weigh 400 or 500 pounds.
Right.
I don't see people with face and neck tattoos everywhere. There are tattoos.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't see a culture that predominates sexual identity, although you can be gay here. You
right.
can be whatever
right.
you want to be,
right.
but the government is not going to enhance it or promote it.
Right.
There's almost a sense of elegance and a pro-family atmosphere that I see here, which is what I think I hear people in our country say they want.
Yeah.
Isn't that kind of ironic?
It's sort of reminiscent of the 50s in America, I remind you.
Yes.
You know, where there was, you know, where we did have what was strong family values were celebrated,
mm-hmm.
but not anymore. And we've seen an increasing number of people, Americans, Canadians, Australians, New Zealanders, moving to Russia.
Yeah.
You know, there's one family, they run a YouTube called Countryside Acres, and they got 8 kids.
Hmm.
They're out in Nizhny Novgorod, and the guy with his 14-year-old son, they built their own house, they built a barn, they built a schoolhouse for the kids. I mean, they built everything.
Why is that? What's the attraction, you think?
Well, because they see in Russia religious freedom.
Hmm.
They see in Russia...
They're building churches here.
Yeah, and they see in Russia that they value children. They embrace children.
Yeah, it's a big deal
and,
here.
Yeah, I mean, it is... If you got kids, you know... Everybody's
doing. Yeah, and by the way, I don't want to sit here like you and I, two gringos, bad-mouthing our country. I love America. I think the United States, the promise of America is fantastic. Something has happened there, though, from both a cultural and I think from a greed standpoint.
Yeah.
That's affected our country enormously.
Well, you know, I've done some recent research on literacy rates. In Russia right now, literacy rates over 98-99%.
Yeah.
In the United States in 2024, it's 79%.
Wow.
That fell from, in 1955, it was around 98%. It's fallen, and they say that of that 79%, people that 50% read at the sixth grade or lower.
Hmm.
Now, you can't have critical thinking skills with that level of lack of literacy.
I want to bring this back to the situation taking place here now. Let's talk a little bit about Ukraine and Russia and this conflict. I know you know a lot about it and think a lot about it. You know, given what we were just saying about how the U.S., it would behoove the U.S. to create relations with a country like Russia that has many of the cultural values that it shares, why is it so hard for Americans to understand that it would benefit them both economic and culturally and militarily and in terms of the position of the world, not to mention to not be pushing Russia into the arms and the embrace of China and every other country out there?
The fundamental difference between Russia and the United States is the United States has never paid a price in blood for its wars.
Hmm.
When you go back to World War II, in the United States, we say, oh, you know, as Trump was saying, yeah, we won that war. In the European theater, European, North Africa, Italy, United States, total combat casualties, KIA, 189,000. Russia, in the Battle of Stalingrad, soldiers alone, 800,000 in one battle.
Good gosh.
Now, I had an experience during my last trip, when I was here in March and got to meet with Foreign Minister Lavrov. I was with 5 other Russians and with Judge Napolitano.
Yeah.
And so I asked the 5 Russians, I said, how many of you have a family member who died or was a casualty in the Great Patriotic War? Every single one of them raised a hand.
That's a big deal here.
I asked Judge, you lose anybody? He goes, no. In my family?
No.
And so what we find out is in the United States, war is profitable.
Yeah.
We make money off of it. Yeah, okay, we lost 58,000 in Vietnam. That's 1 year of car deaths in the United States. Who cares?
Not to mention, you know, Memorial Day is about mattress sales.
Yeah.
Here, Victory Day, I went. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
It is sanctimonious. It's so important to these people.
Yeah. Have you had a chance to go to the Victory Museum yet?
Of course.
Yeah. And one of the most moving places I've ever been.
Yeah.
And one of the guides, there was a young lady in her, you know, she's 24, 25. But when we went downstairs, she was able to pull up the picture of her great-grandfather.
Hmm.
So as I said, everybody in this country has a connection to it. And that's why, you know, Russia has actually been reluctant to get involved with these foreign wars. Very reluctant and very reluctant to escalate.
Did you see my interview yesterday with Medinsky?
No, I did not.
So what he told me, and I think you would find this interesting, is that he doesn't feel like he's negotiating with counterparts who have the authority to be able to make a deal with him. He even went as far as saying they're afraid and fear they could even be assassinated if they get too friendly yeah. or do. What do you make of that?
I think he's exactly right. I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall, and I'm sorry I didn't get to see your interview yesterday with him, when he met with Umarov. Mm. They spent 2 hours and 15 minutes. Now, my guess is that in that time frame, he was telling Umarov, this is your last best deal. Take this,
right.
or what's coming down the pike, you're not going to like, and Ukraine's not going to continue to exist as a country.
And it seems what you just said, those are strong words, Ukraine is not going to continue to exist as a country, because it's obvious right now, just from a military standpoint, Russia has the upper hand. That would be something that if I were the president of Ukraine, I would be very concerned about, and I would be looking at a way to make a deal. Seems like he's going in the opposite direction. Like he yeah. doesn't want a deal. In fact, Medinsky told me yesterday, the folks he negotiated with in 22 are very different from the folks he's negotiating with now.
Yeah. Well, it is because Ukraine is simply a pawn on this chessboard. They are simply a piece to be moved by the West. When you go back and look at the history.
But the hell with the West. You're the country's president. Wouldn't you think you'd care enough about your people to tell the West, go to hell? I'm going to make decisions for my people, my country.
They've been bought and paid for. That's the problem.
Really?
Yeah. I can't get into all the details, but I know that there are 23 members of Congress, Republicans and Democrats,
yeah.
who've been paid millions. One prominent senator, $17.3 million to him.
Yeah.
Another prominent senator, $23 million. One's Republican, one's Democrat.
Yeah.
So this is, like I said, the profit motive in this, and Ukraine is almost a hostage. Hmm. This is a terrorist hostage situation, and the entire Ukrainian nation is being held hostage by NATO.
So it's, well, I think even Keith Kellogg is as neoconish as they come. I mean, this guy is an old man who lives in the, older than us,
yeah.
lives in the era of the Cold War and, yeah. Probably still thinks Stalin's ruling things here. And he came out the other day and he said, this is a proxy war and Putin is right. It's simply a war
Absolutely.
Between Europe and Russia.
Yeah,
and Ukraine has nothing to do with it.
I just had a chance to chat with a retired...
That's a big deal for that guy to say that.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I chatted with a retired General Brzezinski, who's, famous throughout Russia. And, we were talking about the growth of NATO. And he said, the thing that always really puzzled Russia is, like, our army shrinking during that period of the 90s.
Yeah.
The army was shrinking, and they're building up NATO. And then NATO was going out and building new headquarters in Estonia and Latvia and Yavoriv and Western yeah. Ukraine.
But they're just peacekeepers.
Oh, we're here just to spruce it up.
Yeah. Were they peacekeeping in Iraq?
Yeah.
Were they peacekeeping in Belgrade?
We've got...
Are they peacekeeping in Ukraine?
We've got such a karma list on us as Americans.
Yeah.
That if it comes due, we're not going to be able to pay it.
Where do you think this is going to end up?
It's going to end up with the military defeat of Ukraine. This is not going to be a negotiated settlement. It'll be negotiated in the same way that von Paulus of the Sixth Army negotiated the surrender of the Germans at Stalingrad. Russia must militarily defeat Ukraine because it must militarily defeat NATO.
But Russia's not interested, it seems to me, in going past the Dnieper River.
Oh, no.
Right? I mean,
look at all the land that is...
Russia does not need more land.
Yeah, they're not... It's not yeah. Lebensraum.
Poland's okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But they need to create a buffer zone. The Dnieper River is a natural buffer zone.
Yeah.
And Ukraine... Because I don't see Russia going in wanting the headache of having to occupy all of Western Ukraine. But they have to disarm it. It can no longer continue to be this proxy.
Well, it can't be a satellite country for NATO. I mean, that would be crazy. I mean, it has to be a sovereign, independent country.
Ukraine has been a member of NATO, a de facto member of NATO, since 1995. The only difference was they didn't have Article 5 protection, and they didn't have to pay an annual fee. However, the number, I did the list of military exercises conducted by NATO and by EUCOM. Mm-hmm. And do you realize that of the 28, the time period I looked at, of the 28 NATO countries, Ukraine was the sixth most popular location for hosting a NATO exercise.
Wow.
None of the other 21 NATO yeah. countries did.
Well, they were having exercises off the Black Sea just one year before this war broke out.
You had Marines and landing craft landing on the shores of Ukraine.
While Russians were on beaches watching it.
Yes.
And a lot of people don't know that. Yeah. But that video is out there. If you want to look at it, it's on YouTube, by the way. Speaking of YouTube and speaking of alternate media or whatever the hell we want to call it, you've become a superstar in, you know, YouTube. I see you all the time. I see you with Napolitano. I see you with McGregor, all the guys that I know, you know. How big a force is that alternative message? And you think it can combat the neocon message, which the, whatever the hell we want to call it, the mass media, general media, corporate media controls in this country right now?
Yeah, well, thank God it exists. You know, when you and I first met, you know, I started doing my first CNN gig was in August of 1994, the capture of Carlos the Jackal.
Right.
And then after that, I became a common talking head on all terrorism issues. That ceased in 2008 when I opposed Barack Obama. All of a sudden, I became a persona non grata. But now what has happened in the U.S. media, as you know all too well, the censorship, there is not a single person able to explain why Russia is doing what Russia is doing from the Russian perspective, not allowed on any of the networks.
Isn't that amazing?
No, it's, well...
Yes.
It's like...
Even if you disagree with him, you know?
It is.
It's okay to disagree, but give him his ability to say what he thinks.
Exactly. Well, this is... The United States has become what the Soviet Union was in the 1970s.
Hmm.
And Russia has become what the United States once was, with open media, with the ability to debate, with opposite points of view. I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah. Did you know what questions I was going to ask you before you sat down?
So what?
Did you know what questions I was going to ask
you?
Did somebody tell you these are the questions you have to ask and these are the answers you have? Did somebody say that to you here?
There is no, you know.
But I did get that at CNN.
Yeah. RT, and I made this point when I was being interviewed by Brian Stelter because he accused me of being a mouthpiece of Putin. And I said, Brian, the only networks that I've ever been on that didn't do a pre-interview, that wanted to know what I was going to say, that asked the questions, are RT and Iranian Press TV. The only two.
That's a great example.
The only two.
I bet you that freaked him out.
You know, he was outraged.
Right. No,
but that's true.
Well, you and so many other people who I would have, Karen, the general, Kozlowski.
Kotowski,
thank you. And so many others who I would interview when I was at CNN. We had the highest rated show on CNN.
Yeah.
They put me in front of Wolf Blitzer because they said, your ratings are so high, maybe he'll get ratings because of your show. We were killing it, and all of a sudden they started telling me I couldn't have those people on the air. I couldn't talk about certain things. They were angry about it, criticizing foreign policy. And before you knew it, boom, I was out the door.
Yeah.
So it was an effort, and you don't see any of those people today, either on CNN or ABC or CBS or even Fox, to be honest with you. People think Fox is conservative. Yeah, they're conservative on social issues, but when it comes to neocon issues, they're as bad as everybody else.
Yeah, it was only... Tucker Carlson was the only one who was able to get Doug McGregor on.
Mm-hmm.
That's been it. Danny Davis.
And what happened to Tucker after he had Doug McGregor on? Out the door.
Yeah, but, you know, Tucker's now got a larger audience than he ever had at Fox.
Yeah, he has you on and me on, and we've become friends.
Yeah, and I saw you did a great interview with him.
If you're very kind.
People haven't watched it, go watch it.
Yeah. It was very good. It did millions, hundreds of millions, I mean, tens of millions, or I don't know. It was a big number.
Yeah,
because people were interested in that perspective.
Numbers you'd never got at CNN, MSNBC, Fox.
I'll be honest.
Combined.
I was, to share this, because a lot of people don't know this, when I was at CNN, I remember they came to me and they said, you've now broken through the biggest numbers we've ever had since we started, and especially because I was doing very well with young people, African-Americans, Hispanics, and, you know, regular American citizens, so to speak, legacy Americans or whatever we call them these days. And that was a big number, but you know what it was? About 450,000 people. That's not really crazy.
Yeah.
This place, RT, does hundreds of millions.
Yeah.
In just reach.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know. Not to mention Tucker, some of these shows that are taking place now on the Googles, as we like to say, they're doing better than those numbers on CNN.
Right.
So eventually it's got to turn, right?
No, it's like, you know, in the Soviet Union in the 70s, you had the samizdat, you know, the underground press. Now we've got social media. And it's not so much underground, but it is an alternative where people are tuning out of CNN, MSNBC, Fox, ABC, CBS. They're walking away from it because of its control.
And I think it's important for people like me and people like you to come here to share a perspective that Americans would otherwise not be allowed to hear, especially since you consider that Americans are not allowed to hear from Russian or reporters from even other countries in the United States.
Right. Yeah, no, they've gone out of the way to try to... I was fortunate that I had downloaded the RT app on my Apple TV before all the bans went in place, so I still got it. Mm. But if you go on to Apple TV today to try to download RT, can't do it.
Finally, as a former CIA analyst, do you think that the CIA and our interventionism all over the world has become worse today than it was?
Oh, much worse.
I hear it got worse, especially worse after 9/11. Is that true?
Yeah, yeah. In fact, what Trump, to his credit, when he came in and unleashed DOGE on USAID, we began to see the extent to which USAID money is being used to subvert other countries in tandem with the CIA. Hmm. So these information operations that were being run, like in Georgia, so you pay people's tickets, you buy their posters, you pay for their food, you get, you know, they get some walking around cash so they can get into the street.
You create media.
Yes.
Yeah, you make a newspaper that never existed before, but now all of a sudden it's criticizing the country you wanted to take down.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what they did.
By the way, congratulations on this. I'm glad you've landed on your feet here. You deserve to be here.
You're very kind. Thanks for coming.
Oh, my friend.
Let's continue to do this, okay? I think it's important. Thank you so much, Larry. And that's our news. Before we leave you, though, I want to remind you to check out my podcast, Speaking of the Googles, right? It's called Journalistically Speaking. It's doing really, really well. I'm surprised. Thank you very much. You can find it on YouTube or wherever you get your podcast. And you can also, if you want to have a conversation about what Larry and I just talked to, I'm on Twitter or X at Rick Sanchez TV. This is The Sanchez Effect. It's delivered without corporate scripts, without political masters. It's just what's happening. It's raw, it's honest, and it's real. And I'm glad you're there. And we'll see you next time.